We're listening to musicians of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center performing the music of Stefan Volpe, his piece in three parts composed 1961. This is Listen Adventurously. See you next week. You're listening to WORT-FM Madison.
BBC News with Sue Montgomery. The first ever criminal trial of a former US president is about to begin in New York. The case against Donald Trump gets underway with jury selection. He denies falsifying business records to cover up a hush money payment to an adult film star, Stormy Daniels. Neda Taufik is in New York.
Today is the formal start of the trial, but it begins jury selection when hundreds of New Yorkers from Manhattan will be gathered here and will be whittled down to just a jury of 12 individuals and six alternatives. Donald Trump will be there in court through that entire process. The judge will have them first answer a questionnaire that runs 42 questions long, each question with subsets, and it walks the jury through their consumption of media, if they've ever been a supporter of Donald Trump or attended any of his rallies.
Iran has sought to justify its unprecedented attack on Israel, telling Western countries they should appreciate its restraint. An Iranian foreign ministry spokesman said the strikes, involving more than 300 missiles and drones, were a limited act of self-defense. France, Germany and Britain have urged Israel to avoid any escalation. The price of oil has fallen slightly after Iran's attack on Israel. Rising tensions in the Middle East had caused prices to increase in recent weeks, but they've dropped back again, as Theo Leggett explains.
For weeks, traders and analysts have viewed the rising tensions between Israel and Iran with growing concern. This has pushed up prices, with the cost of Brent crude rising from $85 a barrel in mid-March to just over $92 on Friday. However, the limited impact of the attacks themselves, coupled with the clear diplomatic pressure on Israel to avoid escalation, appear to have given the markets some reassurance. As a result, oil prices have fallen back slightly, but remain high.
The French government says it hopes the International Conference on Sudan, being held in Paris, will break the wall of silence around the year-long conflict. The French Foreign Minister, Stéphane Séjourné, said the Sudanese people had been victims of indifference. France has organised the gathering with Germany and the EU to raise desperately needed humanitarian funds. Arnaud Badinier is the mission head for Médecins Sans Frontières in Sudan.
Nobody is coming in the country to support the action. Goods are not coming, and there is no enough food or medicine to enter in the country. You can see in the field that everyone is struggling to find a way to get something in.
The civil war has displaced millions and triggered waves of killings. You're listening to the World News from the BBC.
Attention WORT volunteers and donors. WORT is holding an election for two open participating member seats and one open listener sponsor seat to serve three-year terms on the board of directors of Back Porch Radio Broadcasting, Inc., with terms beginning at the annual meeting in June and concluding at the annual meeting in June 2027. Financial acumen, computer literacy, and a willingness to work within a dynamic group to help shape this great station are all desirable qualifications. People of underrepresented groups are strongly encouraged to apply. Some committee hours are required outside of board meetings. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. on Wednesday, May 15th to ensure consideration. Voting begins Thursday, May 30th and continues until the annual meeting on Sunday, June 30th. More information and board applications are available at WORTFM.org or on paper in the station lobby. Help us keep WORT a vibrant and important part of our community. Apply today.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Budget Bicycle Center's used bicycle showroom located at 930 Regent Street. Open for curbside service estimates and sales, 251-1663. More information on Budget Bicycles services for new and used bicycles is available on the web at budgetbicycleCTR.com.
Thank you. It's 8:06 and you're tuned to the Monday 8 o'clock buzz on WORT 89.9 FM Madison and WORTFM.org. This is Brian Standing. On the program today, we'll take you deep into the belly of the beast, or at least swimming up close and personal with the largest animals the Earth has ever known. Underwater photographer Brian Scarry will join us in advance of his lecture at Madison's Overture Center. And the Madison Psychedelic Society wants to hear about your most epic trip or song, or poem, dance, you name it. They'll be hosting a psychedelic variety show this Friday at the Bartell Theater. Organizers Day host Jablonski and Neil Patton, of course, do not condone the use of illegal drugs, but will be here in the studio to tell us all about this trippy event. And finally, rounding up the program on a very art sort of focused edition of the 8 o'clock buzz, Madison poet, educator, and playwright Charles Payne takes aim at the American educational system with the debut of his play The Classroom Ain't Enough at Broome Street Theater. We'll hear from Charles Payne, director Matt Rhines, and actor Morgan Stewart. We'll have all that, plus some announcements, the Outdoor Adventure Report, a look at the weather, and some tasty tunes served up by our engineer John Wilson with an assist from Charlie Pitton. And all that's coming up right after this. It's 8:10, and you're tuned to the 8 o'clock buzz here on WORT. This is Brian Standing. Brian Scarry has one of those jobs you may have dreamed of when you were a kid. Scarry works as a marine specialist and underwater photojournalist for National Geographic. He's an 11-time winner of the Wildlife Photographer of the Year, has won awards from the Academy of Underwater Arts and Sciences, and his latest multimedia work, The Secrets of the Whales, includes a National Geographic magazine cover story, a book, and a four-part documentary series streaming now on Disney+. On April 23rd, Scarry will speak as part of the Overture Center's Changemaker series. Brian Scarry joins us now by phone. Welcome to the 8 o'clock buzz.
Thanks very much, Brian. Great to be here.
So, as I mentioned, this is like one of those jobs that I think all of us have dreamed of when we were kids. We've all wanted to be underwater photojournalists for National Geographic. Was this a childhood dream of yours, and how did you make it a reality?
It was a young dream for me. I grew up in Massachusetts in a small textile mill town, and even though we didn't live on the water, my parents would take me in the summertime to the beaches of Cape Cod or Rhode Island, and I fell in love with the sea as a child, and I think from that early age, I just wanted to be an ocean explorer. You know, I was watching the old Cousteau documentaries in those days and, you know, reading National Geographic magazine. So I just wanted to be an explorer. And I started scuba diving when I was about 15 years old. And then maybe a year or two later, I went to a diving show, a conference in Boston, and saw underwater photographers and filmmakers presenting their work. And it was like an epiphany. I just decided that's how I want to explore the ocean, with a camera. But in hindsight, it was a very lofty dream. You know, there was maybe two or three underwater photographers working at National Geographic magazine, which was my goal, and they didn't seem to be going anywhere. But, you know, eventually that dream came true, and I've been doing it now for 26 years, and it's just been, yeah, a dream come true, to say the least.
And so tell us a little bit about how you earned your chops and worked your way up. What does one have to do in order to become a National Geographic contract photographer, aside from waiting for the other guys to leave, right?
Yeah, that's one of the key ingredients there. But, you know, I guess there's no real roadmap. There's no template that you have to follow. But in general, obviously, you have to become a photojournalistic type of shooter. You know, it's one thing to make beautiful pictures, which naturally the magazine wants, but you also have to be able to tell stories with images, and that was one of the things that I needed to learn. You know, I went to college and studied photography and photojournalism and filmmaking, television production, and so forth, and then tried to use what I learned in school underwater, which was a very different genre. I, in many ways, consider myself self-taught, but at the end of the day, it's about having a portfolio that will get the attention of the director of photography at a magazine like National Geographic that can see that you can be given an assignment and go out and make those beautiful images that'll make people want to know more, but also the storytelling images that might be, you know, conservation or science or whatever the story's about. So that's really where I needed to get those chops, you know. So I was diving as much as I could. I didn't have the money or resources to travel around the world, so I was working on charter boats, taking people out shipwreck diving in New England, you know, dark, cold water, deep water sometime. But, you know, learning to shoot in those conditions allowed me to be able to shoot anywhere in the world, really.
Now, I mean, did you have any background in marine science or marine biology, or is that part of your work sort of self-taught?
Yeah, it a little of both. I mean, I certainly took a curriculum. Part of my curriculum was in science and biology and marine biology and so forth, but I'm not a scientist. I think I might have wanted to be one if it hadn't been for math, you know, in school. It kind of got in the way, so I picked up a camera instead. But, you know, I have had the privilege of working with so many marine scientists, each of which are often the most worldly person in that field. So if I'm doing a story on great white sharks, I'm working with some of the best white shark scientists. Or if I'm doing a story on leatherback sea turtles, I'm working with the premier leatherback sea turtle scientist. But one of the sort of beautiful things about my career is that having worked with all of these people, I began to see how the puzzle goes together in the ocean. I don't have it all figured out, but, you know, these people are sort of siloed in their research, but I see how leatherback sea turtles might be connected with mola mola or other animals, and you start to see this three-dimensionality and the connectivity in nature that has sort of evolved into my work as well.
So let's talk about the latest project, The Secrets of the Whales. Have you done work with whales before, and what intrigued you about these particular creatures?
Yes, I've done a fair amount of work with whales, and it is, for me, one of the greatest things I can work with in the ocean. I love everything, you know, whether it's a tiny little nudibranch, some invertebrate crawling over the seafloor. I love warm water, cold water, big animals and small. But there's something very special about working with marine mammals in general, and particularly whales. You know, they have big brains, and they are, you know, have a degree of cognition that I think most other animals maybe do not have. And So I'd worked with a number of whales. I'd done stories on some of the most endangered whales in the world, like the right whales, North Atlantic right whales, for example. And I had long been interested in doing a multi-species story or project on whales. But I was searching for the narrative. You know, how would I connect the dots between these multiple species? And it was in doing some research and talking to a friend of mine who's a sperm whale biologist, actually a Canadian biologist, who began to tell me about whale culture, about the fact that some of the latest and greatest science was revealing that whales have culture like humans. And one of the ways he described it was, he said, you know, the difference between behavior and culture is this, that behavior is what we do, culture is how we do it. So, for example, most people eat food with utensils. That is behavior. But whether you use chopsticks or knives and forks is your culture. Turns out whales are doing the same thing. They're not using chopsticks, as far as we know, but depending where in the world they live geographically and how they were taught by their parents or grandparents, they're doing things differently within the same genetic species. So orca in Norway are doing things differently than the orca that live in Argentina, or the, you know, sperm whales have a different language that live in Dominica in the Eastern Caribbean than the ones that live in the Azores in the North Atlantic. So I thought that this was a really unique way of helping people to see the planet through a new lens, through the lens of culture with another species that, in my estimation, could be a bit of a game changer.
When you talk about, for example, orcas in particular parts of the world doing things a particular way, do you have some examples of that? Do they have fads or like culture trends the way humans do?
Well, so certainly dialects. Again, I often use the word language, but I think officially, scientifically, it should be referred to as dialects. But some of these animals, particularly toothed whales like orca or sperm whales, they actually have unique dialects. So rich repertoires of sounds, and the ones that speak a certain dialect in one geographical location is very different, or, you know, substantially different than ones that are in another location. So according to the scientist I work with sperm whales, for example, they say that the first thing a sperm whale does when it meets another sperm whale in the middle of the ocean is to say who they are and where they're from. So, you know, I am Brian from Dominica. And if the other whale says, I am from Haiti, they just kind of go their separate ways and isolate by language or dialect. So when I first heard that, I was reminded of, you know, the neighborhoods of New York City at the turn of the 20th century when, you know, you had all these little enclaves of humans, all genetically the same, but isolated by culture, by language. Or with orca, you mentioned, you know, they are easily, arguably, the most intelligent animal in the ocean, could eat anything they want. They, you know, they can eat great white sharks. However, they have been taught to eat very specific things in many cases, depending where they live and by their parents and grandparents. So the Norwegian orca like to eat herring, and they have developed feeding strategies just to feed on herring, where the Patagonian orca, there's just two families of orca that live in Patagonia, Argentina, and they have developed a taste for sea lion pups. And at a certain time of the year when the pups are going into the water, these matriarchal females have devised a strategy for grabbing those pups right off the beach. And they're the only ones in the world that do that. The ones in Pacific Northwest like to eat salmon. And because of dams that are being placed in rivers, they can't get their salmon. They will actually starve to death rather than eat something else. That's how important salmon is to those orca in the Pacific Northwest. Culturally, it's, you know, ingrained within them. So I think there are a lot of, you know, similarities to human culture in the sense that they're doing things differently within the same species.
Now, there have been a lot of news stories lately over the last year or so about orcas in the Mediterranean that have been deliberately disabling luxury yachts. And apparently, that's a taught behavior. It's been they've traced it back to sort of one individual orca. Do whales learn the same way people do? Do they pass knowledge on from one individual to another?
They do, and in many respects, that is another definition of culture, is this passed on behavior or learning. It's certainly generational learning. You know, when whales are born like humans, they're not born with innate skills. You know, when a shark is born, it it doesn't stay with its mother. It goes off and immediately has these instinctual behaviors. But a whale has to learn. So a humpback whale, for example, spends the first year of its life joined at the hip with its mom, where it's learning all of the skills that it'll need to survive in the ocean. And even those cultural aspects, orca, you know, they're much tighter families. Sperm whales are tighter families. Again, matrilineal, they're led by the older, wiser females of the group that make all the decisions and do the teaching. But, you know, you can see this. I mean, we have in the film, in the series on Disney Plus, you can see grandmothers teaching the orca, grandchildren, how to do this seal grabbing behavior, for example, in Patagonia. And we also show that if there's an orca grandmother living in the family, that the offspring, the calves, tend to live about five times longer than if there is no grandmother. So that generational learning, that family bond, is critically important.
Are they smarter than us?
Well, that's a great question, to be determined, I guess. I would say, you know, in my book, Secrets of the Whales, I say that if I could only photograph one thing for the rest of my life, it would be whales. And if I could only photograph one whale, it would be the orca, because they are scary smart. And I don't think we know quite how intelligent and clever they are, but I would certainly put my money on them being far smarter than we even know.
All right. We've been speaking with underwater photojournalist, marine expert, and documentary filmmaker Brian Skerry. Skerry's presentation, Inside the Secrets of the Whales, takes place on Tuesday, April 23rd at 7:30 p.m. in the Overture Center's Capitol Theater. For tickets and more information, go to overture.org. Brian Skerry, thank you so much for joining us on the 8 o'clock Buzz.
Thank you.
And we'll be back with the Outdoor Adventure Report and Song of the Week coming up right after this. It's 8:25. You're tuned to the 8 o'clock Buzz on WORT. This is Brian Standing. It's time, as we do each and every week, for the Outdoor Adventure Report with master naturalist Paul Noldner. Take it away, Paul.
Good morning, Brian and work folks. It's a beautiful day out there. Your weekly Outdoor Adventure Report is brought to you by Madison Fund, Friends of Urban Nature. The partnership of Parks Environmental Friends groups is helping connect Madison communities and kids with nature everywhere. You can enjoy free, fun, welcoming, diverse, fairly accessible. That means the trail's sort of flat and not fairly smooth. Family and kid-friendly, naturalist-guided, educational bird and nature adventures every week in parks all over Madison and other events hosted by local nature groups. This past week, citizens were able to register their votes online as well as in person on issues affecting wildlife for the annual Wisconsin DNR Conservation Congress spring hearings. That's a welcome change. Seniors enjoy seeing and learning about nature up close with naturalist Kathleen Wolf. Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance and Friends of Cherokee hosted an evening observation of the sky dance of American woodcocks. Friends of amphibians, citizen science volunteers are reporting large numbers of chorus frogs calling. They sound like you run your thumb on a comb. And some leopard frogs joining them as days get warmer. Retired Parks Conservation Manager Cy Whitstern led a pastor's prairie restoration history walk at Owen, and naturalist Alex Singer led a family-friendly ramble at Turbo Point to find trilliums and other beautiful ephemerals. Spring wildflowers that are historically colloquially known as Mayflowers, bringing beauty and cheer to our natural landscapes all over the city. Coming up this week, the Great Wisconsin Birdathon is back this spring, starting today, April 15 to June 15. This fun, informal competition has teams trying to find the most birds in one day they pick, while raising money for the Natural Resources Foundation and local groups. See wibirdathon.org to join a team or make a donation to a team to support these worthy causes. We have more April showers and sunshine coming up this week to help our spring Mayflowers bloom. We can all help get things beautiful for Earth Week, too. Earth Week kicks off this coming Saturday with volunteers. Help pick up trash and help with projects with parks all over Madison. See cityofmadison.com/parks to sign up and help out in a park near you on Saturday, April 20. Groups can contact Parks Volunteer Coordinator John Weichelt to post volunteer opportunities with your group on April 20 and year-round. Folks on the east side can help do a creek cleanup for Earth Week with Friends of Starkweather, for example, meeting Saturday, April 20, 10 a.m. at the Olbrich Canoe Launch by the softball fields. Help beautify this incredible natural creek corridor winding through the middle of the east side. You can join the Friends of Starkweather Creek to help by canoe and on land. Some canoes, vests, and paddles provided, or bring your own if you have them, or walk with cleanup crews along the creek at Starkweather and in parks around Madison, Cherokee, Warner, and on the west side, Owen and others. Join 350.org Forward Marching Band and lots of students on Saturday, April 20 at 1 p.m. at Library Mall for the annual Earth Day March up State Street to the Capitol to support environmental and climate justice. It's always a fun one. On Saturday, April 20, 10 to noon, outing leaders can build accessibility, awareness, and skills with Birding by Ear, Walk, Bird, and Learn at Aldo Leopold Nature Center. Join volunteers and staff affiliated with the Birding by Ear class, Wisconsin Council of the Blind and Visually Impaired, and Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance to advance your leadership skills. This is an outing for leaders to learn how to make walks accessible. See swibirds.org to register. On Sunday, April 20 at 1:30, join naturalist Alex Singer to go find some spring ephemerals, some of those Mayflowers, on a bird and nature adventure at Warner Park, meeting at the Warner Park Rainbow Shelter by the lagoon. This free, fun, family-friendly, fairly accessible walk will follow easy paths in Warner Park and Warner Woods to enjoy the return of spring. Warner Woods is the oldest uncut woods in Madison. It still harbors a variety of beautiful native wildflowers. And Madison naturalist, Parks naturalist Megan McCrum and others on her team have been removing non-native buckthorn and honeysuckle from Siberia that leaf out early, and our native wildflowers are benefiting. Can you find the blotchy green lancet, spear-shaped leaves of trout lily, bloodroots, delicate Dutchman's breeches, and other beautiful Mayflowers? Join Susan Wilwolf, UW Emeritus Botany Scientist, on Sunday, April 21 at 1:30 at the Lakeshore Preserve, meeting at the Picnic Point kiosk, to stroll the paved roads and the fairly level paths of Picnic Point to look for lichens growing on trees and rocks. Lichens are very, very hardy and visible year-round. Symbiosis of both plant and animal, a fungus and an algae. In preparation for this trip, you can download on your cell phone a guide called Lichens of the Lakeshore Preserve from lakeshorepreserve.wisc.edu. Look under field guides. And remember, no collecting at the preserve or in our conservation parks, but it's fascinating to learn about. On Earth Day on Monday, April 22, planning ahead, join local nature groups at Garver Feed Mill from 4 to 6 to learn about PFAS in our local environment, followed by an evening of music with Winging It Bird Band and Ken Lonquist leading fun kids sing along nature songs and other musicians into the evening. Mark your calendar also for Sunday, April 28. for the free annual Earth Week Medicine Fund Bird and Nature Festival at Warner Park with live raptors all afternoon and lots of fun with kids, activities, face painting, kite flying, food carts, and music. More great adventures coming up include Do You Hear a Frog?, Shifting Spring, and another wildflower walk, among many other activities in our parks. You can find details about upcoming adventures online at cityofmadison.com, parks, and on tinyurl.com, Madison Fun Adventures, and on the Facebook and web pages of our local groups. Join nature lovers, families, and friends on nearby outdoor adventures every week, year-round. It's naturally fun.
Thank you, Paul. And it's time for the Song of the Week, but before we get to that, you may have heard some very lovely whale song earlier in the program, very apropos for our interview with Brian Skerry. Charlie Pittman's in the house. She picked some of that that whale song music, and she's got a story about it. Tell us about it.
Well, Brian, when you give me something to run with, I like to run with it. What an opportunity. So when I saw that you were doing a show about whales or doing an interview about whales, I thought, what's some good whale music that we could play legally? And I stumbled across this NPR article about this man who in the 1960s really was the first to record whale song and how that led to later conservation of whales. It's a very cool story. So his name is Roger Payne, and he was a biologist on the East Coast, and he kind of stumbled across these whale recordings through like military researchers and stuff. They were actually recording the sounds of dynamite exploding, instead recorded whales, which were getting in the way. So he stumbled across that, managed to make that connection, and he was just floored by these recordings. And I think he has a perfect quote in this NPR article, which I can't find, but here we go. Here's him describing these sounds. Ready? These sounds are, with no exception that I can think of, the most evocative, most beautiful sounds made by any animal on Earth. So if you want to check that out, you can. He released a whole album.
My parents had that album.
Really?
Songs of the Humpback Whale. Yeah,
no
I remember
way.
It very well.
Wow. It later led, by the way, to popular culture. Judy Collins incorporated it into her song, Whales and Nightingales, which was an album, and Farewell to, I don't know how to say it, Tarwathi? You might know. But later on, you know, they actually banned killing whales, right? By the 1980s. So at least on deep sea whaling. So there you go. There's, my early morning recollection of this NPR article, but mostly whale sounds.
Thanks so much, Jolly. How about a song of the week? You got one of those for us?
Yeah. As the whales kind of coo us, you know, these evocative recordings coo us, we're switching from this to some psychedelic stuff in honor of your next interview. So Bardo Pond is a kind of noisy psych rock band that's been going forever. And this is their song, Despite the Roar, keeping the animal theme. Thank you.
It's 8:36. You're tuned to the 8 o'clock buzz on WORT. This is Brian Standing. For those in the know, April 19th is Bicycle Day, the date in 1943 when Swiss chemist Albert Hofmann ingested 250 micrograms of LSD, went for a bicycle ride, and experienced the first known acid trip. In honor of the 81st anniversary of Hofmann's discovery, the Madison Psychedelic Society is hosting a psychedelic variety show at Madison's Barthel Theater. I'm joined in the studio now by two members of the Madison Psychedelic Society. First up is Neil Patton. Welcome, Neil.
Thank you so much.
Also joining us is Day host Jablonski. Welcome, Day.
Thanks for having us.
All right. So a psychedelic variety show, what does this entail, and what kind of variety are you hoping to have on April 19th?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is an evolution of an event we did last fall, which was a story slam. And this time around, we wanted to open up our arms to just about any kind of entertainer or performer. And so we're hosting this at the Barthel Theater this Friday. And we've got 8 people so far who are confirmed, and that includes 3 spoken word storytelling folks. One of those includes someone who has won awards at the Moth, both in Madison and Milwaukee. We have a fast and aggressive harsh noise music artist. We're going to have a stand-up comedian who will also be using some of their time to perform a cabaret-style song, which they said will be in the vein of Judy Garland, but with some sort of parody or satire lyrics around psychedelics. We've got someone who's going to be performing their poetry with some homemade music. They're going to be bringing some instruments and doing their poetry reading with music. Another poet and singer. And then finally, right now, we've got a magical duet act. It's a husband and wife. They said it's going to be very surrealist with a sense of wonder, humor, and joy. And they've won some awards from the Houdini Club of Wisconsin.
I'm still holding out hope that a clown will join us.
A clown. Okay, you're looking for a psychedelic clown, huh? Yeah. Is that a wise choice? I mean, that might send people off in a dark...
Oh, it's the best idea we've ever had.
Okay, all right. Because a lot of people are scared of clowns, and I could see how that could turn kind of weird at some point. So tell us about the call that you put out for acts or performances here. What were you looking for?
I think we were really looking to expand the creative expressions of people discussing their psychedelic experiences. The Story Slam was so popular that we wanted to open it up to sort of more forms and more exciting.
So are you asking for people to submit things that they wrote while they were tripping? Is that?
Some people were speaking from kind of that inside experience. Some people were just recounting a story. Uh-huh. So I'm hoping that there's a whole range.
All right. Mm-hmm. And so are you still accepting submittals at this point, or are you full up?
No, I think we could still take maybe up to 3 more folks within the amount of time that we're going to be performing at the Barthel. And it's really a wide range. Like I said, I mean, last time it was sort of storytellers, poets, and spoken word folks. But this time we're looking for rappers, comedians and humorists, dancers, musicians, puppeteers, ventriloquists, mimes, clowns, acrobats, contortionists, poi spinners, jugglers, hula hoopers, magicians, and illusionists. Truly, I mean, whatever your talent is, whatever your act is, as long as you can sort of wrap around that theme of a past psychedelic or hallucinogenic experience.
And tell us about the Madison Psychedelic Society. Who are you and what do you do?
Yeah, so we started in 2018, and we were originally inspired by some of the science that's being done at the UW and so many people who wanted to talk about both the science aspect of psychedelics, but also their personal experiences. So we've been going strong ever since then. We have monthly meetings that are kind of a welcome wagon into our community. And now we have a number of organizers who are organizing events, both social and informational, every month.
So psychedelics have sort of had a sort of roller coaster sort of history in terms of sort of popular acceptance. You know, when they were first discovered, they were sought as possible treatments for psychiatric diseases, mental illness. You know, the CIA was very interested in them for a while, and then they had this sort of dark period where they were mainly illegal, and people were, you know, warned about the dangers of bad trips. And so where are we now in sort of the understanding of psychedelics? Are they still this demonized sort of, you know, experience, or are people starting to accept them as a little bit more normalized?
Well, the war on drugs is still going strong, so there is still some demonization. But I think that more and more, especially with the psychedelic science that's being done in the last couple of decades, this is coming into mainstream consciousness, and we're realizing that there is a difference between different drugs, and that we're back to thinking of psychedelics as a psychiatric accompaniment to psychotherapy. So that's a lot of the research that's being done. And then there's also a lot of decriminalization activism being done, trying to make especially plant-based psychedelics decriminalized in the eyes of municipalities around the country. So there's two kind of different veins in bringing these back into mainstream consciousness.
And you mentioned some of the acts that are coming up on the psychedelic variety show. What's your hope for this? I mean, is this something that you're hoping is just going to blossom and become like a major event every April 19th?
I would love that. I've been wanting to have a big bicycle day party for many years, and I love this idea. I hope that a lot of people come out, and I hope that it becomes a regular thing.
And you mentioned that the Psychedelic Story Slam was a big success and inspired you to expand it. Tell us about that. How did people mm-hmm. react to that?
Yeah, so Neil? We did that at the Arts and Literature Lab, and that was in November. We had 9 folks who were actual speakers, and we had a pretty good turnout as well. Maybe about 70 folks came out. And, you know, people shared about experiences that were recent, you know, within the last few months or year, and some were like decades ago, you know, and they were all over the place in a good way. Some were just sort of a positive, you know, lots of laughter. Some were maybe a little bit more challenging in what the dynamic was. But all of them were very engaging and interesting. And the substances as well that people were speaking about really ranged the gamut from what people know, you know, LSD or acid or, you know, magic mushroom, psilocybin, but then other ones that even I wasn't super familiar with. And they were just really interesting to hear, you know, what people's experiences are. Most people, you know, have good experiences. Some people have experiences that are difficult for them, but then become a growth experience after that.
Mm-hmm. And in the 1960s and 70s, Timothy Leary talked a lot about sort of the mind expanding sort of properties of acid and LSD. Are we still looking at that, or are we looking at this more in sort of a more clinical sort of medical sort of framework?
Well, I think that the basis of the clinical and medical framework is understanding that these are mind expanding, right? And is understanding that these psychedelic experiences or hallucinogenic experiences can get deeper into our psyches and deeper into our self-knowledge. So whether people are doing that in a clinical sense or whether people are doing that through their own exploration, I think there is that is the continuing engagement with psychedelics, is that it takes us deeper into ourselves.
And so you mentioned you have some musicians coming up at the variety show?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. We know that someone said they're going to be doing harsh noise music.
Harsh noise,
they described it as being fast and aggressive. And then I do know that at least 2 people might be singing, and one gentleman will be performing his poetry, reading his poetry while doing some instrumentation at the same time.
Now, will either of the two of you be performing?
No.
No?
I'll be enthusiastically clapping.
Yeah. I mean, I'll be hosting and emceeing. You might get some jokes or trivia in between, but definitely don't come to see me. So,
and what is the sort of status of legalization or decriminalization of psychedelics these days? Where are we?
Right. So, federally speaking, psychedelics are still criminalized, still Schedule I, still illegal. More and more, there are municipal-based decriminalization efforts that are usually community activism initiated, and those are working to make psychedelics lowest priority for criminalization in those municipalities. And then a lot of the medicalization and the work that science is doing is working to legalize specific psychedelics for specific psychedelic assisted psychotherapy applications.
And so things like microdosing, is that just edging under the legal limit for, or how does that work?
That's just a different technique of approaching psychedelics where you're not experiencing a perceptual shift, using it in hopes that the biochemistry and what we know about neuroplasticity is being leveraged for those experiences.
All right. We've been speaking with Day host Jablonski and Neil Patton of the Madison Psychedelic Society. The Psychedelic Variety Show takes place on April 19th, Bicycle Day, at 7 o'clock p.m. at Madison's Bartell Theater. For tickets or more information, go to bartelltheater.org. And you're still accepting submittals. How do people do that?
Yeah, if you have any kind of talent or act, you can reach us at madisonpsychedelicsociety@gmail.com. Again, madisonpsychedelicsociety@gmail.com. That's just all one word, no dots or spaces.
All right. And, Day, Neil, thank you both for joining us on the 8 o'clock bus.
Thanks for having us.
We'll be back with folks from The Classroom Ain't Enough theater production right after this.
In addition to the generous support of listener sponsors, the local businesses and organizations that underwrite WORT's programming play a vital role in the financial health of your community radio station. WORT is grateful for the support of our underwriters, and when you visit these businesses and organizations, please let them know that their support of WORT is appreciated. For information on how to become a WORT underwriter, contact me, Doug Holtz, at 608-256-2001 or visit our website at wortfm.org.
Wartstock is coming to Warner Park on Sunday, May 19th, and we're holding a raffle with some great prizes. Winners will take home one of five Summer Music Festival weekend passes, and we've added dinner for six with tequila tastings at Migrants, worth over $700, a pair of season passes to Forward Theater, stays from Marquette and Ruby Marie Hotels, and a crystal and onyx necklace from Goodman's Jewelers. Gift certificates from Sardine, Orange Tree Imports, 10 Pin Alleys, and much, much more. Plus, merch from Wine and Hop Shop, and of course, some great Wart swag. Tickets are $3 each, $2 for $5 and $5 for $10. Drawing is at 5 p.m. at Wartstock, but you do not need to be present to win. Tickets are available at upcoming Wart events or at the station. A complete list of prizes is on our website at wartfm.org. Good luck.
I feel lucky today.
It's 8:10. It's 10 minutes to 9, something like that. Anyway, it's 1977, Entozaki Shangi's collection of choreo poems for colored girls who have considered suicide when the rainbow is enough took the theater world by storm. The original off-Broadway production won an Obie and a Theater World Award, quickly moved to Broadway, where it garnered 2 Tonys, 4 Drama Desk Awards, and yet another Theater World Award. A 2022 Broadway revival received similar acclaim, and Madison area poet, activist, and playwright Charles Payne found Shange's work resonated with his experience with the intersection of Black and Brown communities and the American education system. Payne's new play, The Classroom Ain't Enough, will premiere at Madison's Broome Street Theater on April 19th and runs through May 2nd. Joining us now in the studio is director Matt Rains. Welcome, Matt.
Oh.
Happy to have you on the 8 o'clock bus.
Yeah, thanks for having me here. I'm really excited to be here.
So tell us about what drew you to this play, The Classroom Ain't Enough. How did you find out about it, and what was intriguing enough about it for you to decide to direct?
Yeah, it was the words to begin with. Charles and the producer, Zach, reached out to me last August, and I did a staged reading of the pieces. And I fell in love with all of them. And I was bugging them for months. Can I be in the play? Winter auditions, winter auditions, winter auditions. And I finally got a call back in November. And they were like, well, do you want to direct it instead? And I was like, you saying I get to be everybody in the play? And so I said yes immediately. And it's been such a fun ride.
Is this your first time directing?
It is my second time directing. I directed The Birds with my friend Sean back in October. And I think Zach and Charles saw that and they were like, hey, this is pretty cool. And so they asked me to be on board for this one.
And these are described as choreo poems. Tell us, what's a choreo poem?
Yeah, 100%. I don't really know. I believe it's like slam poetry with movement added to it. What I did, or what my goal is, I guess I'll find out if it's successful or not on Friday, was take a lot of Charles's slam poems that he made and try to make them more like a theatrical dialogue. Just so instead of the rhythm that often is associated with like poetry, we're kind of scaling most of that back, and it's just going to be conversations.
So are you splitting up what would normally be a monologue into a dialogue between two different characters?
No. So a lot of it's like written in kind of like meter where people kind of talk real fast like this. And we're just going to scale all those beats out just so it's like talking like a normal person.
Interesting. And so did you, you did the casting for this? Tell us about the cast.
Yeah. Oh, the cast is awesome. We have Laura McMillan, Christian Kind, Isaiah Doyle, and Morgan D. Stewart. We had open auditions back in December, and we had so the coolest thing about the cast is that it's very rare in Madison to have an all non-white production, and this is, I believe, the second one that Madison's had, it other than The Wiz, that where people are getting paid. And so we put out this call for auditions where I'm like, am I even going to get enough black people to show up to these auditions? Because, I mean, you know, Bartell Theater, the theater in Madison, it's really hard to find non-white actors. And we had 21 people show up. And I was astonished, like, wow, this is awesome. And so we could have cast the play three times over with the amount of talent that we had.
Is that something you're going to pursue in the future?
100%, yeah. Now that I know that people are out here, yeah, I want to do this every year, if not more.
And so, I mean, as we mentioned, Payne, you know, wrote this in response to sort of the idea of how the American education system serves or doesn't serve people of color. Tell us about that theme and
sure.
What did you learn about that from doing this play?
A lot, and also like not a lot, because I guess another reason why they wanted me to direct this play is I used to teach. I was in the education system from 2006 to 2022, and the amount of black and brown kids that I noticed just get sort of swept under the rug, and really to no one's fault. Like, teachers try their best. It just happens that if you have certain types of teachers with certain types of kids and experiences, it's just hard to relate sometimes. And oftentimes those kids will just, they're not being ignored, they're just not being misunderstood. And a lot of stuff that Charles wrote about from the perspective of a black teacher sort of deals with what it's like in certain, he calls them barrios in the play, or certain neighborhoods where these kids need that extra love. And it resonated with me, a lot of things that he says. I don't want to say too much on air because I want people to come see it.
Okay. Do you have a sample reading for us?
I do, yeah. Yeah, I want to read a selection called Stop and Frisk. Is that okay?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Starts off with a question. How old were you when you were first racially profiled by a cop? I was 16. A high school junior in Michigan, captain of my varsity basketball team, and an officer found a reason to pull me over in front of my house. Before I even attempted to pull out my license and registration, my mother ran out of the house. Out came his gun, and up went my hands. She made me and the officer aware of his power. She told us he could shoot me in the head in front of our house, and no one would say a thing because of my tank top. And the officer agreed with her, told me to stop dressing like a criminal and let me off with a warning. My mother made me wear polos whenever I left the house from then on, as if dressing like Carlton Banks could disguise my black body. A decade later, I found myself with a master's degree, teaching at an expensive private school in Phoenix, Arizona, and still, a rent-a-cop security officer pulled his weapon on me in a FedEx parking lot. His car's headlights shined so bright on my face, I dropped my orientation packets and my active shooter training took over. I raised my hands, I said my name and pointed to the staff ID on my work polo. I am blank blank. I work for blank school. I am a blanking teacher. There is no danger in this area. My hands are up. You may approach. There is no need to sweep and secure the space. And the security officer screamed back, "This is private property, boy. You don't belong here." He lowered his weapon and approached with the bright spotlight still burning my eyes. "Transient? No, I am a customer walking to their car." He did not apologize for pointing a gun at me. Me, an unarmed FedEx customer. He never cut off his light. And I looked inside the window to see a black FedEx worker wiping away a single tear running down from his eye. Only to realize I was staring at a reflection of myself wearing one of those damn polos.
Very nice.
Cool.
So that's what do you know about how Charles Payne wrote these things? Are these all from personal experience, or did he talk to other people?
That's a good question. I believe most of them are from his personal experiences. And when he was teaching in Arizona and Indiana, he would just write poems based on his experience, and he would perform them live. I'm pretty sure he won. And don't get mad at me, Charles, if I get this wrong, but I'm pretty sure he won a bunch of gold medals and stuff for some of his poetry, from maybe some selections from this too.
So how do you direct a play like this when you're working with actors? How do you get them to engage with the material? Is that hard, or is it very easy?
It's a little bit of both, because directing like a typical theater play, you got to worry about set design and the blocking is more intense. For this one, it's actor heavy. Like these actors are getting so many lines, like they have thousands of words they have to say, and so it really just relies on their presentation of it, and so oftentimes I just have them stand and I have them, the words do most of the blocking for me. We have some movement and we have some things that are a little not typical that you'll see in theater, but yeah, it's really just all about the words and really taking the time. We spent the first 4 days of rehearsals just combing over the text and just talking about what these words mean and how they can relate to Charles' experience and how they relate to our own experiences, and I'm just hoping that we get some sort of get something out of it, I guess.
Do you have a central vision or theme in mind when you put a production like this together?
Yeah, a lot of it is just sort of focusing on the experience of black and brown people. I think that's a theme that you'll see throughout the entire play. And then also, it's kind of, I don't want to say it's anti-education system, because it's not, but it is very radical. And Charles does have a lot to say about his experience teaching, and I have a lot that I want to say about my experience teaching, and I think we're kind of blending those together.
We've been speaking with director Matt Raines. The play The Classroom Ain't Enough opens at Madison's Broome Street Theater on Friday, April 19th at 7 p.m. and runs through May 2nd. For tickets and more information, go to bstonline.org. Matt, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Brian. It's good seeing you again.
Good seeing you. And that wraps up our program today. I'd like to thank our guests, underwater cinematographer Brian Scarry, day host Jablonski and Neil Patton of the Madison Psychedelic Society, and director Matt Raines. Thanks to our engineer, John Wilson, who piloted the new and improved Mighty WORT soundboard. Thanks also to Charlie Pittman for spinning the music today and for helping out with the engineering. Thanks to our receptionist, Lori Ranney. This is WORT 89.9 FM at Madison. We're also live streaming and podcasting at WORTFM.org. My name is Brian Standing. Global Revolutions is coming up next, right after the Insurgent Radio Kiosk.
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Monday, April 15th.
MedMen here for Action Weirdos Productions. This week in music history for April 15th. The Stamp Act. The Townsend Act. The Intolerable Acts in response to the Boston Tea Party. No taxation without representation. A major spark that set off the revolution that led to the formation of America was taxes. And today is tax day. Here are a couple of songs that remind us that beautiful music can be the product of a bad equation. The Taxman by the Beatles. Recorded in April 1966, it lifts a riff from the famous Batman theme by Neil Hefti, released in January 1966.
There's one for you, 19 for me. 'Cause I'm the time.
The line, one for you and 19 for me, refers to the 95% highest earners tax bracket in the UK at the time. It's a nice song, but I'm actually of a mind that progressive tax is a good idea, especially for top earners and corporations. Unfortunately, sometimes it seems like the government is a corporation. Rye Cooter's Taxes on the Farmer Feeds Us All makes a point about how important things are often taken advantage of the most.
Well, his pants are wearing thin. His condition, it's a sin. 'Cause the taxes on the farmer feeds us all.
And finally, a fun song to help you dance away your tax day blues. Taxman Ska by Baby Love and the Vandangos.
He taxed up water I drink and the air that I breathe now. Oh, Mr. Taxman, he taxed up.
So there you go. Just a couple of songs to get you in the mood to pay your taxes. Or not. Also this week, April 15th, 1894, blues singer Bessie Smith is born. And April 15th, 1973, Alice Cooper is on the cover of Forbes magazine on the heels of the Billion Dollar Babies album. That was this week, years ago. The wages of sin are death. But by the time taxes are taken out, it's just sort of a tired feeling.